speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, March 30th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
Dissecting Obama's strategy on Afghanistan, a look at the most significant environmental bill in U.S. history, and college students in the recession welcome new federal relief.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. On Friday, President Barack Obama outlined his administration's strategy for the war in Afghanistan, calling the situation there perilous. In a White House address before an audience of troops and diplomats heading for Afghanistan, Obama unequivocally defined the goal of the U.S. to, quote, disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan and prevent their return to either country in the future. Warning that the terrorist group was still planning attacks on the U.S. from a haven situated along the border between the two countries, President Obama announced that 4,000 more troops will be sent to Afghanistan in addition to the long-proposed 17,000 troop surge. Their stated objective will be to train and double the size of the Afghan police and army forces. Obama's speech, switching the military focus away from Iraq to Afghanistan, prompted numerous and immediate responses. Amid allegations of corruption in his government, Afghan President Hamid Karzai said Obama's strategy, quote, will bring Afghanistan and the international community closer to success. Not everyone has such optimism, however. Former Democratic Congressman Tom Andrews, now national director of the group Win Without War, stated that the new course for the U.S. in Afghanistan, quote, takes a significant step toward a perilous quagmire. Joining me on the line this morning are David Harris, former editor at the New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone, and author of several books, including The Crisis, The President, the Prophet, and the Shah, 1979, and The Coming of Militant Islam. Also with us, Robert Greenwald, a documentary producer, director, and founder of Brave New Films. He's working on a series of documentary films called Rethink Afghanistan, and he has just returned from a trip to Afghanistan. Welcome to Uprising, David and Robert.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, David. First, your response to what Obama had to say on Friday. A lot of it had been leaked to the press, bits and pieces of it, before he actually unveiled his strategy. How do you compare what Obama is saying he's going to do with what President Bush had been doing in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't see much new here. I think the escalation is about the only new part of it. The premise of our policy is still that somehow the most effective anti-terror approach the United States can take is to occupy other people's countries, which has proven to be a failed policy and will continue to be a failed policy.
Now, he also talked about the training of security forces. He talked about the issue of the drugs and providing alternatives to the drug production. And he also, most significantly, talked about the connection with Pakistan. Is that a significant departure from Bush?
Perhaps emphasizing the connection to Pakistan may change some emphasis there, but otherwise we've been talking about this stuff ever since we got into Afghanistan.
Before we go to Robert, let me play an excerpt of what the president said explaining why we are fighting in those countries. And it's interesting because this is a president who has not invoked the 9/11 tragedy much, either before he was president or after, but in this speech he did it several times.
Many people in the United States and many in partner countries that have sacrificed so much to have a simple question. What is our purpose in Afghanistan? After so many years, they ask, why do our men and women still fight and die there? And they deserve a straightforward answer. So let me be clear. Al-Qaeda and its allies, the terrorists who planned and supported the 9/11 attacks, are in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Multiple intelligence estimates have warned that Al-Qaeda is actively planning attacks on the United States homeland from its safe haven in Pakistan. And if the Afghan government falls to the Taliban or allows al-Qaeda to go unchallenged, that country will again be a base for terrorists who want to kill as many of our people as they possibly can.
And that's President Obama speaking last Friday, unveiling his strategy for Afghanistan. Robert Greenwald, documentary filmmaker, has just returned from Afghanistan. Robert, what is your reaction given your recent talks and meetings with ordinary Afghans? How do you respond to what Obama has unveiled?
Well, I think it's, it's misguided. It's a huge and substantive mistake. And it's wrong on both policy and strategy levels. I spoke to many people during the time I was there. There's tremendous love of Obama. One of the women I spoke to was very strong and emotional about how much hope and promise he holds for their country. But almost nobody there feels that the answer to the problems are further increase in troops. And in fact, that recent Carnegie study that said the greatest single reason for the resurgence of the Taliban is the introduction of foreign troops, number one. Number two, al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan. So it's hard to understand what the reasoning is for bringing in all these troops into Afghanistan. And then finally, virtually everybody I talked to spoke about the need for education, the need for doctors, the need for jobs. And one young man who runs a peace group called the Awakening was talking about, he said, we want you to drop a bomb on us. And I said, what? And he said, yes, an education bomb.
And now on that issue of Pakistan, David Harris, Barack Obama has unveiled in his strategy has combined Pakistan and Afghanistan. But interestingly enough, he said that he would not allow U.S. troops to cross the border into Pakistan if they were pursuing al-Qaeda or Taliban. Yet we are dropping bombs from unmanned drones in the tribal region, another issue that he did not even acknowledge, and very few officials have actually acknowledged openly. So where do you think his Pakistan strategy is? What is it based in?
Well, I don't think it has a basis except a set of artificial hopes that are not likely to come true. This approach of simply picking targets and blowing them up from a distance with drones is another alienation of the population that is already significantly alienated from us. And if these people needed a reason to associate themselves with the enemies of the United States, we're giving it to them all the time.
Now, interestingly enough, so Robert said that the al-Qaeda forces were not in Afghanistan. They were in Pakistan. So there are troops on the ground in Afghanistan, but not in Pakistan. Let's take another listen to what Obama said, specifically focusing on Pakistan and justifying why it was important to extend the war in a certain fashion into Pakistan.
The terrorists within Pakistan's borders are not simply enemies of America or Afghanistan. They are a grave and urgent danger to the people of Pakistan. Al-Qaeda and other violent extremists have killed several thousand Pakistanis since 9/11. They've killed many Pakistani soldiers and police. They assassinated Benazir Bhutto. They've blown up buildings, derailed foreign investment, and threatened the stability of the state. So make no mistake, al-Qaeda and its extremist allies are a cancer that risks killing Pakistan from within.
President Obama addressing his plans for Afghanistan and Pakistan on Friday. My guests are David Harris, former editor of the New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone, author of several books, Robert Greenwald, documentary producer, director, and founder of Brave New Films, working on a series of films called Rethink Afghanistan. Now, what President Obama just said was certainly important, but another thing he didn't mention, which was revealed in a New York Times article last week, March 26th, I believe, was that the Pakistan Pakistani ISI, the intelligence service, has very close links to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and in fact have, in particular, the Taliban, and in fact regularly have strategy meetings with them, help fund their activities and provide them with arms, and that several U.S. aides have acknowledged this as well. David Harris, first, how do you respond to this, and what does this mean for U.S. policy?
Well, it's just a classic example of the foolishness of the policy. Without the Pakistani government in line with our policies and with the Pakistani military in line with our policies, they don't stand a chance in Pakistan. And, you know, the goal here is there's no question about al-Qaeda and that al-Qaeda is an enemy of the United States, but our goal here is to split al-Qaeda off from the Taliban factions in both Pakistan and Afghanistan and isolate them. Any strategy we're going to pursue ought to pursue that kind of isolation. I don't see it in their approach to Pakistan.
And military solutions are always difficult in terms of what you just said. How does one isolate an organization and split it off from its allies through bombs? You can't tell from hundreds of feet up, thousands of feet up in the air, who's a member of al-Qaeda, who's a member of the Taliban, and kill individuals or trap them and imprison them.
It's the dilemma of counterinsurgency. You know, if you can kill the right people, then counterinsurgency works great. But once you start killing the wrong people, it doubles back on itself and does you more harm than good. And in this case, we're setting ourselves up to do more harm to ourselves than good.
Robert Greenwald, the situation on the ground in Afghanistan is pretty dire, as I'm sure you witnessed. But what is their opinion of U.S. policy in terms of the troop presence? And in particular, what do they think of the troop surge? A few years ago, Afghans seemed to be tolerating the U.S. occupation, but now polls show that it's a very unpopular occupation. What did you find?
Well, you just really hit it. You know, it's a very unpopular occupation. And what I found was, and this is almost heartbreaking in a way, see, they believed the promises the last time around. When we helped overthrow the Taliban and promised all kind of aid and help and support in Afghanistan will not be forgotten, unlike here where we're kind of cynical about what our politicians say, many of the folks I spoke to talked about that and talked about the hope and the desire and the belief that all these good support was going to come. They don't want to be, they want to do it themselves, but they wanted the help and support. That, of course, disappeared completely. So it helps explain this tremendous shift in opinion over there, which all of the polls have shown and indicated. And when I would start to talk to them about our Rethink Afghanistan campaign and the questions we want raised and the different, asking for hearings in the United States to raise all of these questions, there was a very strong responsiveness, no matter whether it was very high up in the Karzai government or, people who had to come to me in the dark of night because their lives were in danger.
And speaking of the Karzai government, Obama acknowledged the extreme corruption within the government, but very little mention of the fact that many of the corrupt warlords are our old friends, and also the fact that Karzai doesn't seem to have much legitimacy among his own people today, and he was very much put in place by the Americans.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, that's why, again, the policy is so misguided, because the resurgence of the Taliban, a lot of that is because there's a government that's corrupt, a government that has no legitimacy. And that's where even this, you know, someone who's very high up in the Karzai government said, I wish that you in the United States would put more effort and resources into governance, not into this idea of shooting terrorists or, as someone said, shoot now, think later.
David Harris, another article in the New York Times on Friday revealed that the Pakistani and the Afghan Taliban are putting aside their differences ahead of the Obama surge, an article by Carlotta Gall, who's been based there for a number of years. And this is a pretty disturbing thing, of course, to hear in terms of the troops that are going to go there to meet them. It seems as though they're going to face a united and stronger than ever enemy. What do you foresee in the near future once the troops are on the ground?
Well, I think we lose the battle going in there in the first place. As foreign occupiers, there is no way for us to win. And obviously, we create a situation where we're going to allow our enemies to unite and fight us in a common front, which is the exact opposite of what we ought to be doing with our strategy there. And until there's some recognition of the pointlessness of this approach, we're going to have to suffer defeat after defeat. I mean, remember, this is an area of the world that has never been conquered. The Genghis Khan couldn't do it. Alexander the Great couldn't do it. The British Raj couldn't do it. The Soviet Union couldn't do it.
David, you used a word that Obama used a couple of times on Friday, which is defeat, and you know his promises to defeat the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But what does that word mean exactly, you think? I mean, does he mean killing every last member of these vague groups?
Well, I hope not. If he does, we've signed on for at least a decade worth of war there, and perhaps two or three or four decades worth of war. If the point is to exterminate everybody that's been associated with Al Qaeda, you know, we are fighting this war on their turf. And if we're really going to have a war on terror, then we ought to fight it on our own turf where we have the advantage. And the advantage we have is not in trying to deny them a home base. The advantage we have is whenever they step outside of their home base, where our control of information, our alliances with the rest of the world will allow us to keep their terrorist activities bottled up in Pakistan and the mountainous regions of Afghanistan.
Well, the situation on the ground is pretty grim, particularly for Afghans, and certainly the U.S. bears a long history of responsibility of in terms of keeping the Taliban there, as you've said, or even the various fundamentalist groups. I want to play another excerpt from Obama's speech on Friday, where he talks about the dangers of the Taliban, but of course fails to talk about the U.S. policy leading up to and contributing toward the Taliban being there. And then we'll turn back to Robert. Here again is Obama.
For the Afghan people, the return to Taliban rule would condemn their country to brutal governance, international isolation, a paralyzed economy, and the denial of basic human rights to the Afghan people, especially women and girls.
Robert Greenwald sounds a lot like Bush, that we were going to save, you know, women and girls from the Taliban. What do Afghans think is the best thing that needs to happen? I can't imagine that the Taliban are terribly popular there on the ground, but neither are the warlords. And, of course, neither is the U.S. occupation. It seems as though the Afghan people are surrounded by armed groups that they don't really want. What do they suggest as a way out?
Well, they suggest supporting particularly the women, and I met with a variety of different women, MPs and women's groups, and the women from Rawa, thanks to your help, Sonali, and all of them were very clear and very consistent. Troops will not help us. And they wanted support, they wanted help around education, they wanted help around jobs.
So even though the Taliban is not going to help them either, they still wanted the U.S. troops out?
The Taliban is not going to help them, but the Karzai government is not going to help them. As this woman from Rawa said to me, there are more rapes now than when the Taliban were in control. There are more women in more villages who can't come out. We have to understand that the problem, and this was, I did not know this, I got educated quickly, the women's problem is not just a Taliban problem. It's a problem throughout Afghanistan, and as these five different women all explained to me, that needs to be dealt with in a variety of ways. But bringing 60,000 troops there to fight is not going to help that issue, which they very much see as a human rights issue and as a deeper issue in terms of how do we help the country of Afghanistan.
Robert, I want to stay with you for a moment to talk about your documentary, but a final question to David Harris. You alluded to this a little bit earlier in terms of what you would like to see or what you think needs to happen, taking note of where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are when they step outside Pakistan and Afghanistan. If you were able to give advice to the president on how to better pursue this war, what would you say?
Well, I'd say that we, way back on September 12, 2001, we made a critical decision that we ought to reverse, and that critical decision was to try and seek a military solution through occupation to the issue of terrorist attacks. I think we should seek a legal option instead. We should set up an international tribunals. We should set up international police force. We should monitor the traffic in and out of Afghanistan. We should try to contain that region. But trying to spending all of our resources in the war on terror to support an occupation army simply does not give us the results that we need. We are far safer if we take this as a police action rather than a military action.
Well, David Harris, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
David Harris is former editor at the New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone. He's author of several books, including The Crisis, The President, The Prophet, and The Shah 1979, and The Coming of Military Islam. Still with us, Robert Greenwald, award-winning documentary producer and director, founder of Brave New Films. He's working on a series of films called Rethink Afghanistan, which you can find online at rethinkafghanistan.com. I want to play you the trailer of the film. When we come back from this, we'll ask Robert to tell us a little bit more about what he has planned.
If Afghanistan is unstable, then Pakistan is going to be unstable.
I think the real instability in Pakistan comes from within the Pakistani state.
Almost all the extremist leadership is actually based in Pakistan.
The religious fundamentalism today is a result of the war in Afghanistan, which is spilling over into Pakistan.
People are very suspicious of the United States and whether or not the United States has good intentions for Pakistan.
The United States has a very important interest in a stable Pakistan, a country that's endowed with several dozen nuclear weapons.
You could find nuclear weapons in the hands of Al-Qaeda.
Whatever happens in Afghanistan has a direct impact on Pakistan.
The United States has given this country billions of dollars. Where is the money gone?
History makes clear that you cannot have peace in Afghanistan without cooperation from Pakistan.
The sooner the U.S. gets out of Afghanistan, the better the chances of Pakistan being stabilized.
It should be engraved on the minds of every American diplomat. Do nothing that will further destabilize Pakistan.
And that's a trailer for part two of Robert Greenwald's series of films, Rethink Afghanistan. This one focusing, of course, on Pakistan, as you just heard. Robert, you just returned from Afghanistan, as I mentioned before. And there are several anti-war groups, veteran groups, and families, groups of family, like military families speak out, et cetera, that are in the process of figuring out whether to vote on or how to vote on, including Afghanistan in their opposition to wars. Of course, they've stood against the Iraq war, but now they're considering Afghanistan and not much is known. What is your goal for this series of films?
Well, the films are really part of a campaign, and the campaign is in some ways even more important. We're not waiting to finish the film. What we're doing is releasing a section at a time. It's free and it's online. The first section was about the troops. The second section is about Pakistan. Right now we're working on the cost of war. We'll be doing a section on terrorism. And as soon as we can finish them, and we're fundraising at the same time to get them done, we immediately send them out. And we're very simply and clearly asking for one thing, which is see the videos, help spread them around, which you and your audience are always critical to those battles. And then we're mounting a petition drive so that there will be Senate hearings and House hearings. If we can have national hearings on this, Sonali, and we start to ask some of the simple questions, how many troops, how much money, how long, how do we get out? We know it's easy to get into war, how to get out. We really believe that we can have a significant impact. We're already something like 51% of this country is not in favor of this war. If we can create national hearings with the right people testifying, I think it will be a complete game changer, the way there was around the Vietnam War, tragically late in the battle, but still happened. And so that's why we and various groups and partners are saying, let's use the videos, let's launch an aggressive campaign to make sure we have strong national hearings and all of these issues are brought up.
And Robert, was this your first trip to Afghanistan?
It was.
What was your overall impression just having been there?
Well, there was a fair degree of shock in the sense that you have this extraordinary, really gut-wrenching poverty
right next to the militarization of the culture. I mean, you drive down streets, most of them are not paved. There are literally at every corner one, two, three, five men with guns, huge cement barricades and barbed wire, all of which my guests told me, by the way, is recently new to Kabul. And you have that right next to people who are literally starving, people who are, you know, walking the streets with their children. And the contradiction between the military approach and the passionate needs of these wonderful folks couldn't be clearer.
Well, certainly look forward to the forthcoming episodes of Rethink Afghanistan. Robert Greenwald, thank you as always for the work you do and for joining us today.
And thank you for your help with this.
Robert Greenwald, award-winning documentary producer, director, and founder of Brave New Films. You can find out more about his new project, Rethink Afghanistan, online at rethinkafghanistan.com. We'll also link to it from our website later today at kpfk.org/uprising. Later in the hour, we'll take a look at federal relief promised to college students in this recession. We'll also hear today's subversive historian. And after this short break, a look at the most significant environmental legislation in U.S. history. Stay tuned.
Yodi, he did debo full bene yodi.
Okay, so you're sitting on the freeway or maybe sipping a cup of herb tea. Tired of disinformation, sound bites, or jock radio screaming at you from mainstream media? Hey, it's time to tune into Sojourner Truth, Tuesday morning, 7 to 8 a.m. on Pacifica Radio's KPFK. Hit that dial, 90.7 FM in Southern California, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and catch up on the latest news and views from grassroots movements locally, nationally, and around the world with women, youth, black, brown, and other communities. Hear about the impact of U.S. domestic and foreign policy on people everywhere. Can't get up that early? Not to worry. Listen to the show anytime, download or podcast it by going to kpfk.org. So come hang with us. Check out Sojourner Truth, Tuesday, 7 to 8 a.m. on KPFK, radio powered by the people. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thanks so much for listening.
KPFK's programming is sponsored by listeners like you. Thanks for allowing it to continue by way of your donations.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Both houses of Congress recently passed a wilderness conservation bill, setting aside more than 2 million acres of land in 9 states, in a move that has been hailed as a new dawn for American heritage. Seen as the most significant environmental legislation in the history of the United States, the Omnibus Public Lands Act of 2009 will regenerate forests, protect rivers, extend the national park system, and stand guard over historic battlefields. Former President Bill Clinton passed a law in early 2001 in his last month in office, protecting 60 million acres of national forest land from logging and oil exploration. But within months, the newly inaugurated President George W. Bush rescinded the roadless area protection rule. There is Republican opposition to the new bill as well. The GOP seems to be barking up its version of the environmental tree by claiming the proposed new areas could not be used for wind and solar energy projects if protected. Environmentalists, although supportive of the new bill, are concerned about a provision to accommodate an airport access road through the Alaskan Izimbek National Wildlife Refuge that critics call a, quote, road to nowhere. The president is expected to sign the bill into law today. My guest is Ryan Henson with the California Wilderness Coalition. Welcome to Uprising, Ryan.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, before we get into the details of the bill itself, tell us about the path to where we are today, where the president is expected to sign this into law. How long and arduous was this path, and who were involved in getting the bill to nearly law?
Well, yes, the Omnibus Public Lands Act contains over 160 bills. So, you know, each one of those is a story on its own. But for the California bills, I can tell you that there are three California wilderness measures, and One of them we've been working on for over 3 years, and the one that we've been working on for the least amount of time is about a year. And it's been quite a struggle, particularly in the Senate, where one senator, Republican Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, has the power, basically, and he exercises it, to hold up bills for months and for really for no good reason.
So these measures, nearly 170 separate measures into this one omnibus bill, what are the majority of them designed toward? Is it mostly, as I mentioned, the protection of various lands from energy exploration?
Actually, the majority of the bills involved in the Omnibus Public Lands Act had to do with water, arrangements for tribes, for communities, and a lot of them enjoyed broad bipartisan support. And then the second most common did involve things like wilderness protection bills, such as we had here in California. And the reason why so many bills were rolled into one package is that they had to include one Republican measure for each Democratic measure to try to get enough Republican support to make it past Senator Coburn.
And what were those Republican measures aimed at? I mean, were they also clearly aimed at were they also legitimately environmentalist measures?
Yeah, many of them were actually. They were pretty innocuous local water agreements, and two of the California wilderness bills were sponsored by California Republicans. Howard Buck McKeon of Santa Clarita had sponsored one called the Eastern Sierra and Northern San Gabriel Wild Heritage Act. And also Congresswoman Mary Bono Mack of Palm Springs had one called the California Desert and Mountain Heritage Act. And both of those were perfectly legitimate pro-environmental measures. We're very pleased that they agreed to do them.
And so how specifically does California benefit? It seems as though this state has made out pretty well in terms of environmental standards in this bill.
Yeah, and you know it's because of a lot of very hard work by a lot of people.
What will be protected specifically?
Yeah, some of the newly protected wilderness areas are just really spectacular. In the Eastern Sierra, with Congressman McKeon's bill, we have a place called the White Mountains. It's a desert mountain range that people have been fighting against subsidized mining and other kinds of development on the government lands there, and it's a series of 14,000 foot peaks that stretches from southwestern Nevada into California. It contains the groves of the world's oldest tree, the bristlecone pine, and this is an area that people will be able to continue to visit for free. There's no entrance fee to go there, and several hundred thousand acres of wild country that now are protected with the strictest law on the books when it comes to anti-development measures. And you know, and people should understand these are existing government lands. And what this bill does is it just prevents the government from basically allowing development on them. And, you know, there are lots of places, too, that are near communities. With Congresswoman Mary Bono Mack's bill, there's a place called Beauty Mountain, which is just a few minutes east of Temecula, that people will be able to visit year-round. It won't be some snow-bound peak that it's hard to get to. It'll be it'll be there all the time, and they can go and try to escape from it all.
And yet there won't be development that can happen. Now, development certainly in terms of urban sprawl, but what about energy exploration? And as I understand, the Republicans' opposition, some of it based on these lands that would be protected from wind and solar renewable energy projects as well.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because there is a perceived conflict among a lot of folks between wilderness protection and renewable energy. Well, actually, just energy, period. These areas, we had to prove time and time again, have no oil potential. Luckily, there aren't a lot of lands in California, and I say luckily because because I don't like to see wild places despoiled by it. But the areas that we're talking about here don't have oil potential. They don't have natural gas potential.
Were there other areas that you are aware of that did have oil potential that didn't make it onto this list, whether in California or outside?
Well, I can tell you, though, that there were some places that that had solar development potential. For example, Congresswoman Bono Mack, she... And this sort of proves that the bills didn't withdraw areas from solar and wind development. She insisted that places that could be developed for solar power, that they not be included in the bill. These weren't just places where the industry had applied for permits to build, but places where they might apply for permits to build. And we lost over 10,000 acres just on that alone. Luckily, her bill protected 190,000 acres, so it's not like it got massacred. But still, they demanded lots of adjustments to make sure that we weren't withdrawing critical sites for renewable energy development.
My guest is Ryan Hansen with the California Wilderness Coalition. We're talking about a very significant piece of legislation that is called the Omnibus Public Lands Act of 2009. After an arduous process running over several years, the bill has finally reached the desk of the president, who is expected to sign it today, and it would, among many things, protect public lands from development, from energy exploration. Now, overall, do you feel, given the climate around, well, I use the word climate, but the climate around climate change, Ryan, that the increasing dialogue and the increasing acceptance of the fact that global warming is a reality, that could this bill help keep oil and gas exploration a little bit more in check than otherwise would have been, in terms of pulling more oil resources out of the ground and burning them?
You know, it really can, because despite what I said about California and you know, only a few parts of our state, mostly down in the Southland where you have your audience, only a few parts of the state have oil potential. But in other states, yes, this bill will indeed, such as Colorado, this bill will indeed place a lot of land off limits to oil and gas drilling.
Which is why it's surprising it had bipartisan support, because the Republicans' mantra of drill, 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 seems to run counter to it.
Yeah, and there was a significant amount of Republican opposition. In the end, I believe we picked up over 30 Republicans, which is terrific, but there were people such as Congressman Doc Hastings and Congressman Bishop from Utah who were quite vociferous in their opposition, and it was, much of it was based on energy development, and but in terms of climate change, something really terrific that this bill will do is it's very important that areas at different elevations and widely scattered across different regions be set aside for plants and wildlife so that they can adjust as temperatures increase. They can move up or down in elevation. They can move across the landscape. And I can tell you that in the case of the California areas, We had those sorts of linkages in mind as we worked with the members of Congress to draw the wilderness proposals on the maps. And I think that that's going to have a real significant impact on the future. Hopefully we'll enable animals, or at least give them the space to adjust to climate change over time.
If that's possible, certainly.
If that's possible.
Ryan, finally, I mentioned earlier that one of George W. Bush's first acts in office over 8 years ago was to rescind the act passed under Clinton that was setting aside 60 million acres of national forest land from logging and oil exploration. It seems fortuitous that the timing of this bill, so many years in the making, lands on the desk of President Obama rather than President Bush.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I can't tell you how grateful I am for that. Rolling back the roadless rule in President Bush's first few days was a real blow. Of course, it was an expected one, and we've been battling against him ever since. President Obama hasn't taken any action yet to withdraw the lawsuits against the roadless rule, but we certainly expect him to. And actually, we would like to see that executive order placed into legislation and try to see that go through Congress as well.
Well, Ryan Hansen, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Hansen is with the California Wilderness Coalition, and we've been talking about the Omnibus Public Lands Act of 2009, expected to be signed into law by President Obama today. This is Uprising. Later in the hour, or rather just after today's Subversive Historian, we'll take a look at federal help for college students in the recession. Stay tuned.
Para. Lo juro so que borde chulo lo dio mona la buena como maquinira.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day, on March 30th, 1870, the 15th Amendment was added to the Constitution of the United States. The last of the Reconstruction Amendments attempted to federalize enfranchisement for black males. Three versions of the 15th Amendment were debated in Congress before final ratification. The agreed upon version was moderate, as it simply prohibited states from denying the vote on the basis of race, color, or having been enslaved previously. Radical Republicans in Congress have foreseen the coming of Jim Crow in advocating for a version that went further in terms of prohibiting states from imposing property, literacy, or birth restrictions on the vote. Since that version was not accepted, the South was able to thwart the 15th Amendment by turning to infamous mechanisms such as poll taxes, literacy tests, and grandfather clauses. It would be nearly a century later when an emergent civil rights movement demanded that the Voting Rights Act be legislated so that the 15th Amendment could be fully implemented. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. With the crashing economy making life difficult for many Americans, college students in particular are finding fewer ways to make ends meet. Tuition has risen dramatically over the past decade. In California, the average college tuition rose 37% between 2000 and 2007. And last year, it rose a whopping 9%. Obviously, wages haven't kept up with this dramatic increase, but neither have financial aid grants. Now, college students across the country may see small relief in President Obama's new budget, which aims at dramatically increasing the number of students eligible for Pell Grants. Government Pell Grants were originally designed to cover 80% of the cost of going to college, but given the sharp rise in tuition, they now cover barely a third of the costs. Obama's budget increases the amount of each grant and also makes funding mandatory. At a time when college students are desperately looking for jobs, college graduates in particular, that just aren't materializing, doing so with a smaller debt burden may ease the economic pain of these trying times. My guest is Eric Lotke, the research director director at the Campaign for America's Future. Welcome to Uprising, Eric.
Hello there.
Thanks so much for joining us today. So I mentioned a few stats on how bad it's gotten for college students, in particular the rising tuition, but there's also the rising cost of living in general as well. Can you expand on how tough times are for college kids?
Well, everything's been going up, and it's been going up even as you roll off the numbers for how much it's gone up in the last 5 years, 10 years, depends how you count on which one you're looking at. This is all above inflation, right? So the cost of tuition is rising something like roughly twice as fast as inflation, but then your cost of your food and your room and your board and all of that is going up as well. So the college is basically running out of range of ordinary people. And you see this in things like, I mean, I'm sure people know all of this, but the number of students graduating with more than $25,000 of loan debt has tripled since the early 90s. So people with more than $25,000 worth of loan debt is running up through the roof. And you know, just the general loan debt, you have to turn to banks. Or these days, people can't afford colleges, so they have to go to banks to get the money.
Of course, the rates, then the interest rates are vastly bigger, I imagine, if you turn to banks.
Yes, the interest rates are bigger. And so,
can you defer the paying off of the loans till you graduate for bank loans as well?
Well, ultimately, you have to pay back the money, and ultimately, you have to pay back the interest. The thing that the Obama budget does, this is what's really new and radical, and the banks are going to come after this one. It's in the budget right now. It's in the House version. It's moving forward. But what the federal government has been doing has been subsidizing banks to make these loans. Now, this was a good idea in the 1960s. In the 1960s, banks would not make loans to students. They're young, they don't have assets, they don't have credit histories, they don't have specific business plans, and they wanted what was back then still a lot of money. And banks wouldn't make those loans, and so the federal government intervened in the economy, and they said, well, banks are sensibly not making loans to these people with no assets, no credit history, so we will make an incentive. We will subsidize the banks to make the loans, and we will guarantee the principal in case of default. That's what the federal government did in 1966. They said, banks aren't making these loans. We need to subsidize them to make the loans. And they did that, and it was necessary. The banks then made the loans. The students went to college, and over the next 20 years, students proved to be excellent credit risks. The banks not only were happy to lend to students, they started competing with each other to lend to students.
And, of course,
that also
led to the increasing credit card debt among students, because now they started marketing credit cards to students.
Everybody started going after the student market. And so the credit card debt is separate. This is more about the cost of college, mm-hmm. and how everything is expensive. The good news debt is the fact that students in 1980 and 1990 were able to get a loan. Then Clinton came along in the 90s, and he said, wait a minute, why are we still subsidizing the banks? Banks are falling all over each other to give students loans for credit cards, for tuition, whatever it is. Banks want to make loans to students. Why are we subsidizing them to do it? And so Clinton first questioned it and created an alternative loan program, which does not subsidize the banks. And then it kind of all stalled during the Bush years. What Obama is now doing is putting this back on track. So he is ending the bank subsidies. The bank subsidies cost something like $5 billion a year. The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, scores it at closer to $10 billion a year. This is money that is going to banks. It is direct federal money, taxpayer money, going to banks, paying them to make loans to students.
Of course, at a time when we have this recession, the banks are counting on those subsidies, but the subsidies were intended to offset risks, so they're not really doing what they were intended to do.
They are not needed at all anymore. They're just plain not needed. And so what the Obama budget does is kind of rewinds history and says, wait a minute, what are we doing here? Let's stop subsidizing the banks. Now, this is not about TARP and bailouts and all the rest of it. We could argue whole separately about that whole bank bailout. This is something that's just been in the budget for all of these years, that the banks are getting roughly $5 billion a year from the government, federal government. And so what Obama says is no. The Obama budget stops the subsidies for the banks. Now there's $5 billion that was previously being spent on education, and now the Obama budget says, well, we're still going to spend this money on education. We're not going to give it to the banks. We're going to give it to the students.
So just directly to the students themselves in the form of grants rather than loans?
There is federal lending going on as well, and the federal lending exists. It is being amplified. It will increase. So federal lending will continue to go on, and banks can get money from the federal treasury at a lower interest rate than they can get money from the banks. So that's all good. So the federal lending, direct lending, will continue and will be expanded. And then separately from that, there's money going into the Pell Grants, which are grants. That's a gift. That is money that the federal government is putting into students' pockets. And in this case, it's getting the money directly from the banks. And the federal Pell Grant is going up under the Obama budget up to $5,500 a year next year.
Per grant. So rather than giving a gift to banks, the budget, as it's designed, could give a gift to students to learn.
That's exactly
and,
what it does.
And this is taxpayer money, and students, of course, being taxpayers and their parents and families. So it certainly seems like a great way to, you know, from the perspective of students and people who believe in education at a time when the educational system is becoming so out of reach as well. Let's also talk specifically about where the what you expect to happen to this aspect of the budget as it makes its way through Congress. The banks will oppose it and will lobby hard. Are they going to be strong enough, and what do you see among Republicans and Democrats in terms of whether they agree on this aspect of the budget?
Right. The banks will come after it hard. You are exactly right. And so far, this is not getting – the opposition to this change is not getting a lot of traction. So that at present, this language from the Obama budget, it's in the House, it's in the Senate, people aren't really questioning it. But the budget is being questioned in a lot of ways. People are looking at it and saying, why is Uncle Sam spending all of this money? Look at the size of these deficits and all the rest of it.
And this is also not a very good time to come to the defense of banks, given how much money they're already getting.
Right, which is fine, because we shouldn't be coming to the defense of banks. The question is, should this $5 billion go to students? Right? Maybe it could go to deficit reduction. Maybe it could go to tax cuts. Maybe it could go to all different things that people are going to start pulling out. And what we're saying is, this is what the federal government should be doing. This is why we have a government. People come together and they do things that are for the public good. And students need help to go to college, and everybody wins if we have more people going to college. It's better for the economy, it's better for the student, it's better for all of us, because one of those guys is going to invent something someday. And
But of course, it's not necessarily better for banks. My guest is Eric Lotke, Research Director of the Campaign for America's Future. We just have a few minutes left. Eric, let's talk about just reminding listeners, we talked a little bit about how hard it's gotten for students. As this economy continues to shrink, the help may not come fast enough for many students who are opting out of university education and trying to get any job just to keep food on the plate or stay in their apartment. How fast do you think students can expect this relief, and how severe is the struggle today? I understand that enrollment rates are falling.
Enrollment rates are falling, and costs continue to rise. This Pell Grant program would go into the next school year's programs. So it's as early as this September, right? Because it's now March or April of 2009, and so this can pass as early as this September.
Mm-hmm.
Is when we start getting the increases in grants, and then they stabilize. The other thing that the Obama budget does, which is visionary, is that the Pell Grants, you said this in the intro, it used to be 77% of a Pell Grant would cover 77% of the cost of college. Now it's down to roughly 35% of the cost of college. So the Pell Grant has lost half of its value just because of inflation. And because Pell Grant hasn't been increasing as fast as inflation, and college has been increasing faster than inflation. So the Pell Grant has been cut in half. So the Obama budget gives it a bump up to $5,550 next year. That's partly the bank subsidies that do it. And then what it does is it increases it annually thereafter at inflation plus 1%. So inflation plus 1%, and it makes it a permanent fixture in the budget, so that instead of every year Pell has to go back, the Pell people have to go back to Congress and beg for more, and most years they don't succeed, and every few years they get a small bump up, but it doesn't quite keep up with inflation. This is being put into the permanent part of the budget that just kind of happens automatically, that the Pell Grant program will be renewed. You don't have to go back and beg for it again, and not only that, but it will be renewed at inflation plus 1%.
Erica, so do you recommend people who are excited about this aspect of the Obama budget to lobby there and to pressure there and call their congressional representatives to keep this part of the budget intact?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a great idea. The whole budget's going to come under fight, and people need to support their elected officials who want to do this. Defend this Pell Grant change in particular. Defend this changing of public money from going from the banks to the students. Defend that in particular. And the entire budget is going to come under attack, and the people who support these changes in alternative energy and college tuition and all the rest of it need to let their support be known, because the people who oppose these changes are certainly letting their opposition be known.
And more information can be found at your group's website, which is at?
OurFuture.org. OurFuture.org.
OurFuture.org. Eric Lotke, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Eric Lotke is Research Director of the Campaign for America's Future. Again, more information at OurFuture.org. And we'll link to it from our site later today as well. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Klaus Moser once said, "Education costs money, but then so does ignorance." That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Louise Grillmer is our intern. And Nadia Richardson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. today at our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and see you tomorrow at 8.